Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. During her prolific career, American author Toni Morrison was noted for her expert examination of the condition of race in America. The voices of her unforgettable characters were distinctive and powerful, earning her a Pulitzer, a National Book Award, the Medal of Honor, and a Nobel Prize in Literature. Since her death in August at the age of 88, publishing industry insiders and others in the book business and in literature have returned to the issue of diversity in literature, both among authors and in their stories. Chrissy Harris is a selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What do they teach student librarians about diversity? Is it a topic, or is it even a topic, or is it a whole class?
I imagine it is. It's actually been a little while since I've been in library school, so it's been almost 15 years since I was in library
school. What did you learn about the idea of it?
You know what? I don't remember anything about diversity in ours. I did take some cataloging classes and that kind of thing. I wasn't really focused on public librarianship in the public services sector when I was going through library school. So there may have been things that I missed, but I'm sure things are changing. And the discussion is coming up because it's a topic that is discussed at Book Expo, where there's publishing industry folks. There's all sorts of panels at American Library Association get-togethers and conferences. And the idea is that it's more than just talk, that people will use that in everyday work.
So tell me what your role is when it comes to diversifying the contents of the library, such as it is. What does a selection librarian do? How does that figure in your role?
Well, as a selection librarian, me and my colleagues select the materials for the Columbus Metropolitan Library. We have centralized selection, so one team does the selection for the whole library system. It's much more efficient, and we have a good system view of what's popular and what's not. So we are looking at diversity. We're looking at all our orders that we're buying. What are we missing from this list? We really do have to seek out some diversity in what is fed to us and what we see the most of. The way the publishing industry is set up, you really have to dig sometimes. One example is in linguistic diversity. We try to buy books in Nepali, Somali to support our community. It's hard to find those in the United States in general. And so most of those are published through small publishers. They don't have money to promote. They don't always work well with libraries. They're used to small bookstores.
What about translations and that kind of a thing?
Translations, there's actually, it's funny you brought that up, there's a new Harper imprint. So the imprint is part of a larger publishing house. So Harper Via is going to start publishing books only in translation. They're starting with fiction. So they're publishing authors who are Iranian, Korean, Venezuelan. There's all sorts of different authors that are going to have that big publishing push behind them. And I think that sometimes people read books in translation and don't even realize they're in translation. Mm-hmm. So I think those books, there's already a market for them.
There's the whole, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So there's another side of the equation to this, and that is stoking the appetite for this and educating people about why it matters. How does the library figure into that?
That's right. When we work on how our displays look in our branches, we talk about diversity, including diversity in those displays. Lists that we put out for the public, we make sure that those are diverse. There's a wide range of perspectives on those. Our author visits, we have the Carnegie Author Series. Jessamyn Ward will be at the main library on September 22nd as part of that. We have four authors a year, so we try to make sure there's a wide range of people in that four authors. And then also just doing that deep dive for things that we don't see, not the top 10 in the bestseller list, but we want to do that complete dive so we can have a well-rounded collection. So when people come into the library, they see themselves represented and they have a chance to try a different perspective.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of diversity in literature, not only by who writes, but also who what the consumers are seeing and reading about. My guest right now, Chrissy Harris, she's a selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are inspired by the recent passing of the the amazing author by any measure, Toni Morrison, who she died in August at the age of 88. We're going to be talking more thoroughly about Toni Morrison coming up later in the show. If you have thoughts about her, did she change a trajectory for you like she did for one of my upcoming guests? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. What is the universe of diversity? So far, we've sort of been talking in terms of ethnicity and skin color, but it's a much larger universe than that.
Sure, it is. It's what gender you identify with, your sexual identity, economic diversity, area of the world that you're from. If you're reading about if you're reading a mystery that's set in Vietnam, you're going to get a little bit of a different perspective than if you're talking about something that's set here in the U.S. or British mysteries or something like that. It is all sorts of different perspectives, even different family types. If you're maybe more in children's literature, when you're talking about the nuclear family is always represented well, but you want something a little different for the people who don't have that family.
A lot of times when we talk about what librarians pick for the libraries, we seem to focus more on children's literature and young adult.
Yes.
And that is important, right?
Yes.
Why?
It is important. I mean, well, first of all, the younger generation is more diverse than ever. So if they're seeing something that's not diverse, it doesn't even ring true to them. That's not what they're growing up with. And it's also important to show them different. I mean, they can't watch as many different things on TV or see this. They're not reading newspapers. They're relying on books and what they are watching to give them a perspective of the world around them. And just to see that all experiences can be universal, but there's some differences too.
I was listening to a great interview yesterday that Sarah McCammon on NPR did with two writers in a woman's band, a country band of women. And they said that they get from the recording studios and stuff that it just doesn't sell, that we already have one like you, so we don't need – we already have enough girl bands. And they're like, as if you don't have enough, Luke bands.
Right.
And do you get that when you were talking about the publishing houses? Is that kind of – well, it's not profitable. They've done kind of metric study of this and –
yes, that's what the publishing industry says. The Ripped Bodice is a romance bookstore, and they've actually pioneered this, let's see what it's called, the state of racial diversity in romance publishing. And romance is actually an area where there's supposed to be more diversity, but it's still very low. So in a report, they said that 7.7% of books published in the romance industry were by an author of color, which is ridiculous. And that's the third year that they had done the study. They were hoping that it would improve after doing it in 2016. But they said that 80% of their bestsellers were by authors of color. So the idea that it doesn't sell, it's just not true. Everyone can pull out an example of a book that was by an author of color or by some different group from another country and it didn't sell, but that's the majority of books don't make the bestseller list.
Right. Can you talk about what you know about what Columbus readers want and how what their appetite is for diverse literature, and meaning diverse on all levels?
Well, with our 23 locations, we have a diverse group of readers. So something that is popular at New Albany might not be popular at Driving Park. So we have the opportunity to buy so many things and place it in a location that maybe it will check out. So there's a lot coming out lately that has been really popular. I mentioned the romance industry. Mm-hmm. There's a couple. Helen Huang writes about the character who's autistic. She's autistic, so she represents herself through her characters. And we've got Red, White, and Royal Blue is about the first son of the President of the United States falls in love with the Prince of Wales. So it's a great romance featuring male leads. And it's those two have been so popular. Helen Hong's books, The Kiss Quotient is one of those. I think we've got a huge appetite for them. And we just need to stop thinking of it as a different thing. We would like the industry to be so diverse that you don't have to read, if you are not into literary fiction, you don't have to read a literary fiction book to get some diversity, or you don't have to read a romance. There's sci-fi. We want sci-fi.
I was going
to
say sci-fi or futurism has always been a great opportunity because there's this idea that we will be more diverse. Well, we know we will be. It'll
right.
be majority-minority. By the middle of the century.
Yeah. And Afrofuturism, I mean, with Black Panther,
yeah.
but also in books, it's just becoming a real trend.
You have a Quick Picks collection that you work with. How does that play into all of this?
Yes. Good question. I buy our Quick Pick collection, which is a lot of fun because I get to look ahead to the month ahead and just see what do I think is going to be popular. And comparing that to what I see, I mentioned we have to dig sometimes to find books. There's books that I know are going to be popular with our customers, and I make them quick picks, but they're not high on our lists of things that we receive. Emails from publishers. Sometimes you have to really dig, and you're like, why didn't I see this? So it's interesting, and we give feedback to when we go to Book Expo or other conventions or something, that we tell them that our customers have a demand for this. And the Quick Pick collection is great because you can't reserve it, you can't renew it. It's almost always there's books on the shelf for you to just browse, face out, look at. And so things that people might not have heard about and they see it on the Quick Pick collection, they'll check it out.
And you know that they like it.
Oh, we get comments from customers all the time. If a branch doesn't have very many Quick Picks in the building, it's an almost emergency.
And libraries, I know we're kind of spoiled in Columbus because we have such a great library system, and I know it's not the way it is everywhere. When you talk to librarians around the country, what are their challenges? Money?
I think that we are lucky in Ohio in general that
yeah.
money is not the issue that it is in other places. Some people have a lot bigger struggle. So yes, when something is popular, we can act on it quickly and we can get lots of copies, and have it there for the customers. You know, I think the big thing is time for a lot of libraries, just more, different tasks that customers are coming in and they don't have that reference question of how to fix my car. They're looking that up on YouTube, but there are a lot more social issues and a lot more that people are doing with children. We have homework help centers, but that is something now that is happening in a lot of locations around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just providing a space for kids to do homework, but also having volunteers and materials, and takes a lot of time.
Libraries are very multifaceted. A big growing or emerging, I should say, genre is, you know, veterans and veteran stories. You know, again, another minority mm-hmm. of people that you don't hear what they've gone through for lots of good reasons. But you're reading Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning
yes.
by Elliot Ackerman and his account of his time in and out of combat. What's that telling you about what we're missing about these stories?
Well, that is interesting, too. And one way reviews help us is calling out things that you might have missed. So in the beginning of the book, in the introduction of that book, he compares himself to an Iraqi who fought against the United States, I think. But now they're fighting in Syria. And he's just comparing the two. And it's like, well, how equitable is that comparison? I'm getting the American perspective from there. I also read, I think it was called The Long Shot, which is a memoir by a sniper who is in Syria. So I really enjoyed getting the two different perspectives.
Right, and we know that there are multitudes of perspectives.
Exactly, yes.
And that's what we're missing. My guest is Chrissy Harris. She's selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. We're talking about diversity in literature. What does it even mean? It's not just about the color of your skin. It's about your ethnic background. It's about where you come from. It's about where your parents come from. It's about Native Americans, LGBTQ issues. We just talked about veterans. There's a lot of points of view to get to today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We are inspired to this conversation by the recent passing of the beloved writer Toni Morrison. She died in August at the age of 88. We will be talking about her, too. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Toni Morrison was one of the most beloved writers in history and a pioneer for diverse and unique perspectives in fiction. Since her death in August at the age of 88, publishing industry insiders and others in the book business have returned to the issue of diversity in literature, both among authors and in their stories. Still with us is selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library, Chrissy Harris. Coretha Mitchell is an award-winning author, a literary historian, a cultural critic, and associate professor of English at Ohio State. Her book, From Slave Cabins to the White House, Homemade Citizenship in African American Culture, will be published in summer 2020. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coretha Mitchell, you contributed an essay to the 2012 volume, Toni Morrison, 40 Years in the Clearing. And in it, you write about the influence of Morrison on your own literary pursuits, basically, were it not for her, et cetera, right?
Absolutely. I would not be here at all. I read The Bluest Eye in college, and it absolutely changed my life. It was the first time that I could understand the experiences I had had through high school, as some of these things didn't happen simply because I'm Black. They also happened because I'm Black and female. And that was amazing to have language for that. And so it began the journey of my actually wanting to pursue a PhD, because up until that point, I had been taught authors of color only in so much as, oh, well, it's the right thing to do to give them a little space.
In February.
Exactly, right?
Black History Month, right, yeah.
Exactly. It's the right thing to do. But when I encountered that, it was the beginning of starting to see, no, these authors are contributing to a rich legacy that's worthy of study as much as Shakespeare or anything else.
It's the so much of what we've, you know, I grew up reading about American history, I had to conjecture the African American, the Native American roles and all of that, because all it came was from the white perspective, the majority perspective, and that was that white privilege that I didn't even realize I had, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think part of what's powerful about the topic that we're discussing today, I think, is that if we really step back, we can recognize that the authors that we're taught to put on a pedestal as thinking that they are, you know, the be-all, end-all of aesthetic contribution and that they're the classics— but most importantly, that we identify with their characters. The truth is, those are unique experiences. Whiteness comes with unique experiences. So when you read Huckleberry Finn, you're dealing with a unique experience of this boy who has this adventure. He has an alcoholic father who he's scared of. Like, all of those things are very particular, but we're all taught to identify with him and see universal themes in it. And I think that part of what we're talking about is the importance of approaching all literature in that way. If we made it more of a habit to think about, how do I identify with the humanity of this character? If that were our reading practice and we weren't simply taught to do that with white characters or with characters in other dominant identity categories, right? That straight characters, mm-hmm. that we automatically identify with them. And if we encounter a queer character, then all of a sudden we take this anthropological approach, like, ooh, what is this interesting creature?
As a versus, what do we have in common?
Exactly.
Not what it makes us different. You're nodding, Chrissy.
I just think it's funny. I have a quote here by Beverly Jenkins, who is an African-American romance writer, and she was saying that she would get pushback from readers, and they can't relate. They would walk by her table at conferences, and she's like, you're reading books about werewolves and shapeshifters, but you can't relate to this story about Black African-Americans finding love. It was just... That was just such a good quote there. That
how separated we are emotionally from, but on so many levels, yeah.
I think, to my mind, what it is, it's about our practices. We're all taught in school to identify with characters in dominant identity categories. And what I'm pushing for is, how do we recognize that as a reading practice? When we say that those stories are universal and have universal appeal, it's simply because we're in the practice of seeing it. And so I just want to challenge us all, teachers, as well as general readers, to really think about, what are my reading practices and what's keeping me from seeing the universal appeal of these other stories? And that is not a limitation on the story. It's my own limitation. How can I raise the standard on myself to read more broadly and critically?
We're taught that we have more in common with someone who might be a billionaire but the same color skin than somebody who is more, socioeconomically like me but has a different color skin.
There it is. There it is. And so that's a reading practice, and we can all do better with that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Caritha Mitchell. She's an author, literary historian, cultural critic, and associate professor of English at Ohio State. Also with us, Chrissy Harris. She's selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And we're talking about diversity in literature and what it means and why it matters. And if you have a question or comment about that, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Kate in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm an educator, and I would say that I love the Central Ohio Library System. I'm able to get so many books quickly for my students and to use as resources.
Mm-hmm.
But I teach in a residential facility where students are hospital-bound,
mm-hmm.
and I have trouble... Before I taught here, I was on the west side as well. I'd get books for my students in the library and pick them up. But now they're not able to go to the library to check out their own books. And it's just hard to find books for them, for young adults, African-American young adults that they're interested in, easily. I've been on Amazon, and they're pretty expensive. And then Half Price Books will donate books to us, but it's always the Diary of the Wimpy Kid or those series. So just, there's not a lot of variety.
And Chrissy Harris, you're saying there actually is. It's just, it's not floating to the top.
I don't know if there's a lot.
Okay.
I would encourage you to talk to a librarian, and they can maybe help you find some things that aren't immediately obvious. I do think that teen is one area that's improving maybe quicker than adult fiction in terms of diversity, but there's still not a lot of stuff out there. But we're trying to get what we can, just in terms of all sorts of diversity. So I would talk to a librarian and mm-hmm. see if you – I don't know if you'd be eligible for a teacher collection or a teacher card where you could check out a collection of items that a teen librarian could put together for you. We have some really devoted teen readers in our staff. So I think that if we even needed to put a call out to a group of librarians, they could help out.
Katie, thanks a lot and good luck with that. You're talking about devoted teen readers. You're talking about adults who
yes.
are devoted to teen literature, young adult literature, and I like to kind of almost routinely read young adult literature. I want to know what young adults are reading, and why we categorize things in that way, again, is food for thought. Do you think, Caritha Mitchell?
It's interesting. I had this conversation with my students last semester because our anthology included a story that said that it was for children, and it was very advanced and rigorous in terms of dealing with hard topics like sexual abuse. And so the question was, are you sure that this is for children? And so we had this conversation to think about, well, what do we think literature should do? Do we think that it should challenge us at every age? And if we do, then might that be a way to get beyond this idea that, you know, young adults should not deal with certain topics and adults should? And of course, now you can think about those examples of, you know, teachers and parents who want to ban certain books for certain reasons. So it seems to me that we should really ask ourselves what we want literature to do. And if we want it to challenge us, then that's worth exploring.
In her Nobel Prize acceptance speech, Toni Morrison called language the measure of our lives. And I wondered what that means to you, how that translates for you, Caritha Mitchell.
Interesting. I mean, I think part of what she says is that we all live, but the language, we do language, and that's what changes how we understand it, how we understand our lives and give our lives meaning. So to my mind, it's about how do we understand not only what it is that we have to say, but also how are the discourses that we're bombarded with, how are they shaping our experience? So one of the ways that Morrison's interventions in that regard helped me is to have us really think about what are the things that make us assume that this is the natural and right thing, and can we get to the point where we can actually read that which is parading as right? So, for example, the idea of heteronormativity, the idea that obviously I would want to have a relationship with someone of the opposite sex. God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Those kinds of ideas feel like natural truth, but they're actually language that's handed down to us and that we've accepted so much that it feels like truth. So part of what I see language as is, are we able to read more critically all of the things that we're bombarded with so that we don't simply accept them, but that we can read them critically? And I feel like that's part of what she has helped me to do. One of the things that has guided the way I engage her in the book that you mentioned, From Slave Cabins to the White House, she talks about how to write a race-specific house without it being racist. And so part of her project is thinking about what does it mean to be African American in this country that has always tried to make you anything but a citizen. And so to deal with that in a very specific way, but that isn't reifying the racism that you're bombarded with, that is part of the power of language, both being able to use it, but also being able to read it and not just accept it, but to have a critical eye on it.
And I'm thinking about when you present books or collections of books on any kind of given topic, on any kind of diverse, you know, with a diverse point of view, how careful are you, Chrissy Harris, with your language and just the presentation of it to avoid that reinforcing the categories themselves?
It's true. And I think in adult fiction too, if you're calling it something out as different, then that's doing exactly what you're saying. And so what we try to do when we're talking about how to talk to customers about books is you just talk about what you enjoyed about the book or what the customer might like about the book.
Instead of preaching that it's a very important African-American writer.
Exactly. We don't want to have to have, you know, assigned reading.
Yeah.
We're adults now and we don't want to have to do that. So you want to enjoy what you're reading. And so emphasizing what the, you know, we talk about doorways when we're talking about books a lot of times. Is it language? Is it the plot? Is it the characters? So we try to emphasize those instead of, well, this book, you know, it's a male-male romance. I mean, I did say that earlier, but we were talking about it in terms of this. If I was describing that book to a customer, I would describe it a lot different. And actually, we have a Book Buzz program, and that was one of the ones that I talked about in the spring is Red, White, and Royal Blue. And we're going to have a couple more this October for the for the public, so you can come and listen to some books and what's going to be big this fall. And we make sure those lists are diverse. Another thing that we look for is own voices. And this was a hashtag that was started by Corinne. I think her name is Dauvis. So she's talking about if an author is part of a marginalized group and they're writing about that marginalized group. So you get an authentic experience. I mean, one person with a disability is not going to speak for everyone with all disabilities or even that disability that they have. But you're more likely to get an authentic experience, and you're not having someone say, well, we already have a black sci-fi book coming out this year, and it happens to be by a white author, and, you know, where's the representation there? So own voices is something that's coming into use a lot. It's not saying that all books need to be all books about a marginalized group need to be about that group, or that you can only write about what you've experienced, but it is just a good marker to know that this is probably an authentic experience and they're doing it without stereotypes.
Could I add, the other thing that this is reminding me of is the way that I love to kind of use as a hook Ohio itself. And so I really like to emphasize, okay, we're Buckeyes. How about we think about Ohio authors? And, of course, Morrison is a perfect example.
Lorraine, Ohio.
Right?
Yeah, native of Lorraine, yeah.
Right? Paul Lawrence Dunbar mm-hmm. from Dayton. Charles Chestnut had a lot of Cleveland connections. Francis Harper, who wrote an 1892 novel called Iola Leroy, which I've edited, has a lot of Ohio ties, and of course, Rita Dove. So I feel like that's one of the other strategies we can use is to kind of think about the local as a way to understand how complex even the local experience is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, I wanted to talk about academia for just a second. But before we do, it looks like we're getting coming up on a break. I want to take that break and then come back to that and talk about these the kind of the culture wars in academia over this. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the conversations about diversity in literature in the wake of the passing of Toni Morrison at the age of 88. Of course, the great writer Toni Morrison in August. My guests are Caritha Mitchell. She's an author, literary historian, cultural critic, and associate professor of English at Ohio State. And also with us, Chrissy Harris, selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, I certainly welcome it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Toni Morrison was one of the most beloved writers in history and a pioneer for diverse and unique perspectives in fiction. She won the Pulitzer, was a Nobel laureate, and in 2012 was a recipient of the Medal of Honor, the highest civilian honor in the U.S. Not only that, but she was the first African-American female editor at Random House. Since her death in August at the age of 88, publishing industry insiders and others in the book business have returned to the topic of diversity in literature, both among authors and in their stories. Of course, I say that acknowledging that plenty of people never left that discussion. Still with us is selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library, Chrissy Harris, and Caritha Mitchell, an award-winning author, literary historian, cultural critic, and associate professor of English at Ohio State. So, Caritha Mitchell, during the break, you were telling us about Frances Harper and also the book she wrote that you edited 100 years later or more, Iola Leroy or Shadows Uplifted. That's the name of the book. It's fiction. Tell us about this, because this is that, to me, sort of the missing link, one of the missing links. It's another perspective from that time.
Absolutely. So Frances Harper, I would say, is one of the most important black women of the 19th century. She was as prominent as Frederick Douglass, but because of how things go in a racist, sexist country, her name kind of drops out in a way that it shouldn't be. So Iola Leroy is actually her fourth novel, and it was the novel that she published as an actual bound book. Other novels that she wrote were serialized in periodicals. But this is such an important text because it covers slavery, emancipation, and the years after emancipation. So it's a text that I've taught for every year almost of the 14 years that I've been a professor at Ohio State. And I finally realized, wait a second, I've been using an edition of this text from 1987, and I admire the person who edited it, but why haven't I been more annoyed that I don't have a more up-to-date edition? And so that's when—
How do you do that? How do you update it?
So basically what I did is Broadview Editions, they have this wonderful format where you do a thorough introduction, you do heavy footnotes so that students don't even have to look up a dictionary word, and then you can have appendices with primary documents. And I believe that Iola Leroy was the perfect novel to have that kind of scholarly apparatus. I was able to— A lot of Iola Leroy is about finding lost loved ones who were sold away from you during slavery after emancipation. And so having the appendices allowed me to give you primary documents where people during slavery are dictating parts of letters. So let's say an owner was away with the husband who was enslaved and his wife was still at home with the wife who was enslaved. And they allowed each other to dictate parts of the letter to the other enslaved person. Oh. So I have examples of letters like that. Then after emancipation, I have examples of people who took out ads in newspapers literally around the country looking for lost loved ones. In the most extreme example that I put into the appendix, it was a brother who was looking for the sister he hadn't seen in more than 35 years. So because the Broadview edition allowed me to have that kind of apparatus, that's the reason I wanted to do it as a Broadview edition. So it's the perfect text to teach this country's history, slavery, emancipation, post-emancipation.
And it's fiction, but it's based on
and it's
a real
fiction.
Story.
It's fiction. Actually, 100% fiction.
Okay.
And so part of what is delightful about it is it allows us to really, as I was saying earlier, right, we have this assumption that aesthetic choices and, you know, universal appeal, all of those things are what authors from dominant categories do. And then when we get to someone like a black woman author, we assume, oh, well, let's see what sociological insights we can have. This novel allows us to really think seriously about what are the creative choices that she made, because there are all kinds of things she could have done that she didn't do, things that, right? So one of the things about Iola is that she can pass for white and does for a lot of her life because she's blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and doesn't actually know that she has so-called African blood until until later in life. So it's a wonderful novel to allow us to think about the realities of U.S. history, but also the creative choices that someone like Frances Harper made. She was huge as an orator and poet long before she started writing novels, and so the understanding of her as an artist and writer is really something I can easily highlight, and that novel allows me to do it.
As a librarian, Chrissy Harris, how do you bring forth that kind of literature from long ago that didn't get the reception that it would have for many reasons, not the least of which she was African-American woman?
Honestly, a new edition helps a lot. A lot of times just an updated cover will draw people to something. If it's a new edition, sometimes we'll even put it on the new bookshelf just so people can see it, because otherwise it could get lost in the stacks. But having a personal champion for it or someone who is promoting the book will really help too.
Is there a lot that's been lost?
You know, lost is such an interesting term, of course, because when you're
in— It still can be found.
Yeah.
But
I think that this is the reason why I'm so committed to doing as much public work as I can do, is because for scholars like me, it's not lost. I, you know, went through graduate school learning
about
her.
You've taught it for years, right?
Yeah. And so, but your point is so well taken, right? It's like when I got more serious about doing workshops like the workshop for librarians that I mentioned to you during the break, or workshops for K through 12 teachers, which I've done in New Jersey and other places, once I got more serious about that, I think it got me to thinking more about what can I put out there that is easily accessible. So this edition is one, doing podcast episodes about the N-word and teaching with the N-word and, you know, how to be responsible with it. Those kinds of efforts are my increasing awareness of the need to not only talk to other scholars, but talk to the public.
And, is, you know, by the way, I mean, I mentioned before we took the last break that Toni Morrison was the first African-American woman editor at Random House. What about that piece, that kind of middleman or middlewoman piece in all of this? Does that make a difference, do you think, Chrissy Harris?
Oh, definitely. I mean,
The gatekeepers.
There's so many layers that a book goes through before it's published. There's the book design, the reviewers. There's just so many layers. And if a publisher doesn't see a market for a book, they're going to pass on it. But if it's just they're not seeing the audience because it's outside of their perspective, then that's a problem. So having diversity in the publishing industry at all levels, sales, so you market your book in the right places. I mean, how big is that? Marketing is such a big part of a successful book, because the more people see it, the more people have a chance to check it out or to buy it.
It also seems important, though, that we are really deliberate about talking about what the barriers are, you know, that we have to be honest about the fact that racism is at play, right? The more we don't admit that, the more we can't actually tackle the problem. So part of what this conversation has made me think about is in 1993, when I was an undergraduate in a classroom of a professor that I absolutely adored, he had a guest speaker, a white male guest speaker, come in. And he said, you know, do we know who won the Nobel Prize this year? And we said, Toni Morrison. And he said, yes, it's a good time to be black and a woman. And then just drop that bomb. And everyone's looking at me. But then he moves on and says, who are some of the other winners? And there's a list. And he has nothing to say about that, right? So it's an example of suggesting that, well, she is getting this honor because she's black and a woman. Mm-hmm. But all of the white men who got this honor, it had nothing to do with the fact that they were white and male.
It's also still good to be white and a male in this country.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the more we act as if we can say, so if we're talking about race and we only mark people of color, if we're talking about sexuality and we only mark queer people, and we're not marking straight people, we're not marking white people, then we're not simply describing, we're actually reinforcing a hierarchy that makes it possible for people to not notice that there's no diversity in the room. So to me, it's really important that we mark all of those categories and have a rigorous conversation around that, because then we can recognize, oh, wait a second, maybe I should actually be reading the work of scholars and critics of color. Maybe the reviews of books that I read shouldn't simply be by white people or straight people, because the truth is there are people in marginalized identity categories who are working in all of these fields and working against the grain and against all odds. They're doing that work whether they get the recognition or not. And it's up to us to really be aggressive about actually listening to those voices so that our perspective can be changed. Because it's not that the work isn't being done and isn't being done at a high level, but we have to be aggressive about understanding that if we simply go with the flow, we will reproduce racism, sexism, heterosexism, classism, ableism, etc. We have to be deliberate.
One good thing that about the rise of YouTube and all of that, Instagram, there's independent people who are just reviewing books for fun, and they often are more diverse. And so it takes more time to find those, but they have a really unique perspective. I mean, there's a whole Bookstagram and BookTube where people just talk about books.
Yeah. And music and all kinds of things like that. Yeah. Karen in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I came into the program when you were talking about young adult literature, and I just wanted to give a shout out to Ohio author Virginia Hamilton. I think her work has been so thought-provoking, and though it's often or most often categorized as young adult, I think she has a lot of adult kind of content and thought-provoking content in her book. So I just wanted to give a shout out to, she's a multiple award winner. So I think Virginia Hamilton's worthy of thinking about.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You know, we talk about young children's literature a lot in these kind of terms. You know, that tends to be the focus a lot, at least on this program, too. You know, talk about, well, how are we teaching kids about all this stuff? And it doesn't always have to necessarily be a story about diversity. It could be just the pictures that you see in the book that suggest more more diversity. And how much, when we're talking about children, is that a focus of what you look at, Chrissy Harris?
It definitely is a focus. I mean, we were talking about board books the other day, which are the ones for babies, and how one was talking about different foods, and they mentioned kimchi. And it's just like, okay, normally in the past you might have had books with broccoli and carrots, and this one has kimchi in it. And how great that someone can say, oh, yeah, we eat kimchi, and talk about it with their baby as they're reading the book. The diversity is very important for us when we're reading. Unfortunately, I think the creators of the content haven't caught up as much as the look of the book.
Okay.
It's a lot. The authors and illustrators still tend to be white. And I think that part of it is because publishers aren't going to take a chance on a new.
Once again, they're,
it's a new.
It's perceived as a
book,
risk.
Or it's a new whatever book that has been so successful for us in the past. So we're going to keep, you know, if this author wants to do two books a year, then we're going to publish those two books a year. If they want to do four books a year, we want to publish those books because they're so popular.
Mm. Well, it's also interesting. So you brought up kind of the visuals. One of my students actually teaches really young children, and we just read the narrative of Henry Box Brown, which is about the black man who literally mailed himself in a box from slavery to freedom in Philadelphia, and was in this box for 27 hours. And so there's a children's book about that. And when he showed me the book, what you said is exactly what stood out to me, was how gorgeous the pictures were and how, like, curly his hair was, and how that made sense, that that is what he would look like. And because I've seen the actual pictures that were in the 19th century version, it's like, yes, this is accurate. But you're right. Definitely the author of that book is a white woman. But you're right. The visuals matter. Representation matters. We can't continue to act as if white children seeing themselves reflected all over the place doesn't have a positive impact. It does. And so if it has a positive impact for them, why wouldn't it have a positive impact for children of color? The other book you're making me think about is about to come out. She Came to Slay, which is by Erica Dunbar Armstrong, award-winning scholar. And this is a more youth-oriented version of Harriet Tubman's life, just because, as you say, it has those visuals and it's kind of taking seriously thinking about visuals. But she's, you know, a historian. So, of course, you're also getting all of the authentic and historically based documents.
You know, just, I mean, there's going to be a movie coming out about Harriet Tubman, which
yes.
is going to be a big, you know, interest, you know, it's going to curry a lot of interest in her and in the whole Underground Railroad thing, which is so incredibly fascinating. The Black Panther, I'm sure I'll have a show on Harriet Tubman. You know, when the Black Panther movie came out, you know, I was just fascinated by that. And, you know, we did that when, Crazy Rich Asians. I mean, there is more, but it's so little that it's notable, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
So true. So true. The other thing that you're making me think about, though, is Carol Anderson wrote a really important book called White Rage, and a young adult version of it has now been published. So I think that, again, it's about how we just have to be deliberate about finding the material and making sure that we're reading it with the same kind of rigor that we read anything else, I guess.
Hmm. I think How to Be an Anti-Racist is going to have a young reader's edition coming out as well. I'm not sure if it's next year or the year after that, though. I think it was just announced, but
And there's interest in that.
Oh, yes.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chrissy Harris, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Chrissy Harris is a selection librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And Caretha Mitchell, thanks so much. And we look forward to the 2020 book.
From Slave Cabins to the White House.
That's coming out next summer, and we'll talk about it then. That's Caretha Mitchell. She's an author, literary historian, cultural critic, and associate professor of English at Ohio State. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.